What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
This is CX of M Radio, the voice of customer experience professionals.
UX Podcast. This is your host, Darren Hood. Thank you for joining me on today. And as always, a very special welcome to those of you who are tuning in for the first time. We are continuing, even though it's outside of the month of May. I promised to bring you some guests. We want to go back and have some people who've been on the show previously to come out and be part of an anniversary celebration. So we consider this an extended celebration, and I've got another guest with me on today, one of our prior guests on the show, Justin Ranton, is with us on today. Thank you, Justin, for taking the time to join us today, and go ahead, we'll let you, I like to let people introduce themselves, so we're going to let Justin give his intro, and then we're going to dive in and just start covering some at-large topics that we feel are hot and important to the UX community. So, Justin, tell the folks who you are.
Thanks for having me, Darren. It's always great to talk to you. We don't get to catch up enough, so I love these chats with you. For those that don't know, I'm Justin. I have been doing UX for a better part of the last 10 years now and doing design for about 18 years, starting in graphic design. And I'm currently the director and head of user experience at AliveCore, a healthcare company where we are changing the landscape of cardiological care for folks with AFib and other cardiovascular diseases. So doing some fun work out there, but that's the short of it.
That's fantastic stuff. I want to throw one question in because it just hit me and I think somebody's going to want to hear this. And we talked about this a little bit before, so it might be a little bit of a repeat, but Justin, tell the people how you made your transition into UX.
So, as getting started in graphic design really young, I was doing, show flyers and CD artwork for bands that I was in when I was younger. And that transitioned into, hey, can you do business cards for like my mom and pop type businesses? My dad's got a lawn care company, which slowly became websites and stuff. But the real transition happened, studying design and things. In about 2013, I was in a real bad motorcycle accident. And from there, I started learning how to build websites and things. And that's really where the transition happened. I started going real deep, taking all of the courses that I can, absorbing all the information into what UX was and how it was impacting the work that I was doing. It all boiled down to helping people achieve something with the products that I was creating, websites or marketing collateral that I was creating. And I wanted to understand more around why people were doing the behaviors that I wanted them to do and how I could help promote them. And so over the years, I've started to formulate this kind of opinion that I have now, which is I can't actually design anybody's experience. All that I can do is create the environment or stage an environment for someone to have the best possible experience. So I've started to remove myself from the equation a little bit and think more about what are the building blocks that people need to be successful in their experiences from both the, you know, achieving our business goals and what we're trying to do, but also how do we help people have more emotional value and emotional connection and brand equity with the products and services that we're putting out for people and elevating the quality of life all around. And over the last couple of years, I've really started transitioning to supporting the ideology around humane technology and humane design, accessibility, inclusion, and diversity, which are key components in the work that I do today.
Fantastic stuff. I know somebody is going to be inspired by that. And we talk about people transitioning into UX. Everybody in UX has some type of a transition story. There are very few people that are coming straight into UX as their first job in the world. Yes, some people, but there's most of us transition from somewhere. And most of the people today that are getting into it, from what I've seen, are transitioning in. So transition stories are really critical, especially when you talk about how you leverage what you did do and how it becomes relevant on the UX side, because those transition experiences, they're critical. What you did before, when you can understand the UX and how it related to the work you did previously and help to align that with what you're going to do when you come into UX, it empowers you. So I definitely encourage everybody to become aware of that. It doesn't make you qualified per se. I can do UX because I did this. No, it's just going to help you and empower you to make the transition. So we want you to be realistic about that, but it's really important stuff. And so make sure you understand that today. Can't encourage people to do that enough. So let's get into the topics. We did our, what we call a warm up, and we're just talking, and five critical topics came up while we were quote unquote warming up, and something else may come up too, but we're going to start off today by just talking about accountability and what accountability means. How is it critical to UX operation as a whole, to the discipline, and different examples of where we see accountability and how it benefits us, and where we don't see accountability and what the consequences are. So basically, why is accountability important and what is it? So you want to start us off on this topic, Justin?
Sure. Well, you know, I think it's important that we kind of maybe we start with defining what accountability is, mm-hmm. right? So yep. I think Merriam-Webster defines accountability as an obligation or willingness to accept. This is a really hard word for some people, to accept responsibility or to account for one's actions. Yes. And I think this can be kind of interpreted in a lot of ways as we think about design. It could be accountability for our processes, accountability for the decisions that we're making, accountability for supporting our teammates, accountability for the impact that we're trying to drive. You know, we all have a job description at the end of the day about what we're trying to accomplish. So there's the accountability from the business standpoint of what mm-hmm. we need to deliver.
Yep.
And then as UX designers, we have, or UX professionals in general, we have accountability to the most important thing, which is in our title, which is the users, the people that are using our products. So we have to be held accountable from that perspective as well. So I think there's a lot to unpack around accountability, but I think that's a good place to start.
Absolutely. I know this is a hot topic. Debbie Levitt loves the topic of accountability and brings it up quite a bit. And I know one of the first thing that comes to mind for me with regard to accountability, you talked about the job responsibilities. You look at the job description. What are you accountable for? What does the business expect from you? And we take that a step further. How well are you doing what you're supposed to be accountable for? And how well did you apply UX principles and acumen to the work that you're doing, to the project you're working on? Okay, it's done. How well did you do? Where are the opportunities for improvement? It's like people are just doing things and then they're just moving on to the next thing in the average experience today. They just, okay, we're done with that. Okay, let's celebrate. Okay, on to the next thing. And then we just slap some designs in a screen and then we run off. And so people are churning out work, but the accountability factor on average, a lot of times, at least that, they're churning out the work, but there's no accountability. And when there's no accountability, have you really hit the KPIs? Are there any KPIs at all? Some people don't. They don't work the KPIs. Right. Have you delivered? Did you even know what the KPIs were before you started so you can make sure to use that as a metric to gauge your work and be accountable to those KPIs? Because remember, we have to help people to understand the value that we bring. I have this conversation often, no matter where I've worked and just talking to people everywhere about the fact that when it comes to doing the UX work, we've got to be able to, everybody doesn't know who we are. Put it to you that way. Everybody doesn't know who we are. Everybody doesn't know what we do. Everybody doesn't know what to expect from us. And those KPIs, different metrics, the business speak that revolves around our work, we need to be able to demonstrate accountability to that because the business folks know what accountability is. And ironically, mm-hmm. in a lot of UX circles, as stated, there is no accountability. So if there is no accountability, how are you going to communicate your impact to the business? And how do you know where you stand? How do you know where you need to grow? And so accountability is huge. And these are the things that comes to the forefront of my mind. The more accountability we have, the more powerful we'll be, I feel, yeah. as UX practitioners. Because, man, that UX team, they really help us to knock those KPIs out of the park. Man, that UX team, they really understand us. How many times do you hear that? You don't, right? For the most part, because a lot of people are so busy. I say this a lot too, Justin. A lot of people want the UX jobs, but they don't want to do the UX work.
Yeah.
And in a lot of other instances, they're willing to do the UX work, but really don't know how the UX work integrates into the entire business operation, which now that cuts off your ability to communicate effectually.
So, I think there's some systemic problems with that point right there. Yeah. Not your point, but in the environment that we all work in, there's systemic problems with why that's the reality. And it has a lot to do with lack of equal footing between mm-hmm. the people that are doing the work and the teams that they're supporting, like UX being equally footed with product and engineering and marketing and all the other disciplines at the company. And I think it's a wildly crazy issue. And then being led, the other opportunity here, I think, for improvement would be organizations that have design leaders, which I would consider like a more traditional creative director, leading user experience professionals and research designers that maybe doesn't have or possess the acumen to actually hold those people accountable, right? I think is a real potential problem as well that we face too.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, so it's a challenge, but I think, you know, one of the things that is, you know, obviously this point that you're making and what we're talking about ties into like the boot camping challenges that we're faced with today, the fragmented education, the fragmented learning experiences. You know, I'm self-educated UXer. I've done a lot of boot camps. I've done a lot of courses online and things like that. But the difference is the application, how I've applied it, understanding the science behind it, the repetition that put into the work to understand it over the years. Mm-hmm. You know, in my first role as a UX designer, I technically should not have had, hopefully the company that hired me doesn't hit it, but I technically shouldn't have had, but I'm fortunate for the opportunity because it put me on a career path, a trajectory. Mm-hmm. I got somebody took a risk on me, and because of good accountability on that person's part, I delivered and Bingo. I became successful.
Bingo.
Right. I delivered and I became successful. And not only was I accountable for the stuff that I delivered, I was also accountable for the stuff that I wasn't delivering, how I was representing the company, how I was, what I was doing behind the scenes that people didn't see. What were my processes like? Was I sticking to a process? Was I modifying my process over time and learning new things about it? I was held accountable whenever I remember this moment really clearly. I'm a big personality typically. Over the years, I have really kind of dialed it back, but I used to just say whatever was on my mind. And in my first UX role, I was a consultant, right? So I came to a very large meeting. We were going to be redesigning a corporate website, our flagship corporate website. And I was sitting in the call and I'm listening to the chief marketing officer of the company at the time say, I can't remember the exact example he gave or what he was trying to accomplish. And I had been at the company for like 3 weeks, 4 weeks, something like that, Darren. Mm-hmm. I said, that's a terrible idea. And all of a sudden, I've got, we were using like Teams, Microsoft Teams or something. And my chat like is just blowing up. My boss is telling me you can't talk like that. My coworkers are telling me you can't talk like that. I didn't say anything, bad words or anything, but I called the chief. I'm like a little peon consultant, you know, but I developed respect with that guy in the long run. I mean, after standing up and explaining, then it was like, okay, it gave me the opportunity to hold myself accountable, right? Because then it was, why is this a bad idea? And who the hell are you? Right. So, and I was afforded that opportunity. So I think, that plays into accountability that we're talking about is the stuff that you're not delivering, but how you also advocate, stand up for the profession. Don't let people degrade our profession, steal our jobs, the democratization aspect of what we're trying to do. And, people thinking that they understand, they know the best decision without any data or any background in the field. So, a lot of accountability stuff here.
Yeah. A couple things you mentioned there, another aspect of accountability that usually goes under the radar is accountability, the marriage between accountability and education. I'm always reminded that when it comes to education, and I'll take a step back, I'm getting my PhD in educational leadership. So maybe this is something that resonates with me possibly more than others. But when you establish an educational resource, I don't care what the subject matter is, does not matter what the subject matter is at all. When you have an educational resource, the way that you optimize the way that the pedagogy is established, the way that the curriculum is structured so that you can build a strong learning experience is to partner with organizations to understand what do you need a graduate to be able to do. A lot of people don't even know this happens. So institutions of higher learning, they connect with the large corporations, small corporations, everybody, and they try to get an understanding of what they're supposed to be producing because education is supposed to be producing something. There is a product and it is right. A functional individual that can go into the workspace and become a viable society of our working economics, if you will. So a lot of universities are great at it. Colleges, great at it. Even community colleges, great at it. But a lot of folks are not doing it at all. So this accountability between the people that are educating and the people that are going to hire those who are educated, if that accountability is not there, because that's what that is. It's accountability. Otherwise, the universities would just throw together anything and the organizations would be left, hey, I can't hire any of these people. They can't do what we need them to do. So they talk, they get things structured so that they know what to teach in their courses. And this is not happening. And for me, it's a huge pain point because I've been more vocal about this more recently than I have and going to be delivering some workshops on this in the not too distant future. But a lot of the education today in UX is downright predatory. They know using the classic economic equation with regard to supply and demand, they know there's a demand. People know there's a demand. So they launch into that whole free enterprise mindset. Well, there's a demand. I can put together some classes. And the justification is I can make some money. I can deliver some classes and make some money. So you have people that are getting into educational resources. They're putting together these educational programs for UXers, but they have zero accountability to the organizations that they're trying to develop people for. And then the people who are enrolling, there's no caveat emptor. They just, all they see is an educational resource, and they look to see if they can afford it, and in they go. And another accountability factor that's overlooked in education is that in most instances, not in the for-profit universities as much as it is in the others, you have to compete for a spot. If you want, I remember trying to go to Arizona State for my PhD. I did not get accepted. I got accepted at another school. I got rejected at two schools when I was trying to enroll somewhere. And we get so used to, I want to go to that school, so I just go. No, that's not how it works. You have to apply, then you have to compete with other applicants, and they only want the best students attending their university. One of the reasons is because they want a high graduation rate, and they want their graduates to get into the working world and make them look good, because if you graduate, get into the working world and make the school look good, that results in more people enrolling in their program, and then the economics of education just continues to go round and round. That's not happening. A lot of places, all you got to do is show up with the money, say you want to do it, and away you go. And there's no accountability. There's no accountability there. There's no accountability with the way the classes are structured, which is why people graduate. And we hear it over and over again. I don't care where somebody learned. I don't care whether they went to a boot camp, whether they went to university. I'm pulling for you. And I repeat this often. But the reality is, if you can't do what the people at the companies that would hire you need you to do, you don't have a value prop. The chances of you getting in there is slim to none.
Too many people think that the education stops at the boot camp. When I walk out of here with this certificate of completion, I think I know everything that there is to know. The people that I think succeed out of the boot camp are the ones that realize that there is so much more.
Yes.
That the boot camp is just, it's a Kickstarter is all it is. It's just to give you a taste of what's out there to see if you're interested in it. And unfortunately, there's a lot of people charging a lot of money to get that little bit of a taste for some stuff. And I've seen some pretty bad portfolio project. Not that the design was bad, not that the design work was bad, but that the concept of the project itself was really terrible. It was broken. It had a lot of gaps in it. It wasn't a complete solution. Oh, well, we didn't have time. Then the boot camp wasn't long enough. You need to go through the entire process. You need to deliver an end-to-end product. You need to be able to work with engineers. You need to be able to work with product managers, stakeholders, and it needs to feel and resemble some semblance to the real life of what the situation is. And I would probably go on as far to say that most of the people teaching these courses haven't had that level of exposure in an enterprise, let alone a startup where you're wearing all the hats at the same time.
Yep.
But in an enterprise place where it's very high demanding on output and longevity output and performance within the company for any kind of merit increase or bonus. There's just a lot that is not included in those conversations. And your point around the lack of accountability, whether people want to realize it or not, the school has no accountability to the student either. When you read the fine print, there is no accountability.
Ooh, yes.
they say they're there for you to help you find a job, but at the end of the day, they're not going to give you a job. So like the Google certificate's a great example of that. I'm sorry. I'm going to say it. And I'll say this, I took their class after they put it out. I did the same thing with IBM, right? So I've been studying UX for a number of years and learning about it. And then I see these certificates start bumping up. I don't even watch the videos. I just take the test at the end just to see what the questions are going to be. And then I get certified, right? So you can actually do them and get the certification without actually having to do the work, which further debunks it, right? Like, so just be careful. I love what you always say. Use critical thinking, vet the people that are mentoring you, make sure that they know what the hell they're talking about. Sorry. Anyway, so I'll leave it there.
It was funny. You made me think about in the Google program. A lot of people don't know this. I told somebody else. Tolu was interviewing me, and I shared that the Google program, or the Google started an apprenticeship program and clearly stated that if you were an attendee or graduate, I believe graduate, if you graduated from their UX program, you were not eligible to be an apprentice. You could not join them. What kind of a pseudo negative endorsement is that? That's really on your weird. Own program that you will not, they're telling you that they don't have any confidence in their own program. You would think that if they had, I set up an internal certification at a company that I was working at. We were trying to build people that could come through that program and we could build our own talent pool inside the company.
Yep.
By doing this. So I'm not going to roll something out and then say, oh, by the way, if you take this program, you can't be a part of our team. That's insanity. That is absolute insanity. So Google is telling you that they're not confident. They're doing it for other reasons. Sorry, Google. But, you know, you did it. So I'm just calling a spade a spade. If the sky is blue, sky is blue. I'm not going to say it's purple. It's blue. And that's just the way it is. So interesting stuff. And one of the things about the boot camps, I believe I talk about this on my episode about the UX boot camp brouhaha. A lot of the boot camps, again, great idea. The boot camp was a great idea. It just wasn't executed the way it should have been. They could go back to the drawing board and fix it. They possibly could. But one thing you'll never do on any day of the week is hire graduates. You graduate on Friday and you're teaching in the boot camp on Tuesday and you have no experience at all. The teachers need to be able to lead the students somewhere viable. And you don't teach in places where I've taught, you don't teach unless you have something to offer students besides leading them through some coursework.
Right.
It is not enough.
Examples. Right. Yeah. There have to be examples, real life application. The practicality of it. It has to be there. Right. And this is why I stopped going to conferences like UX conferences and things, because a lot of it was like inspirational talks. Right. There are definitely those that are not, but there are a lot of that type of thing. And the inspirational part of it's great, but you get to a certain point where it's like, okay, where's the practical application of this? How do I use this in my everyday life? Right.
Zero.
Yeah. So, and they can't do that. If they come out of a boot camp and start teaching, I had somebody hit me up to teach a class on user research, knowing that I'm not a traditional academic type user researcher. Uh-huh. Right. And, you know, there were three courses. There was a UX, there was a design class, a portfolio creation class, and then a research class. And for whatever reason, I was the prime candidate to teach the UX research class. I'm like, I don't have that background and I can't lead people through that. I hire experts in research to do this work because while I understand the value of it and I want to have a research driven department because I know that it has to be there. It's a vital part of what I do. Doesn't mean that it does not mean I'm an expert in the field. And by any means, I understand the methodologies and stuff, but that to me is like the old adage or the old statement that people have where they say, you know, I know enough to be dangerous and that's the reality, but I'm smart enough to realize that that's the truth, right? Like right. I can be very dangerous with that. So I make recommendations and I tell the research team, I say, hey, you tell me, here's what I think should happen. You tell me whether I'm right or wrong. And then next time I won't make the mistake twice.
Right, right. Yeah. I wish people would recognize these things, but yeah, it is what it is. And I try to help as many people as I can to recognize those pitfalls, those potholes so that they don't have to. I want folks to have a good trip. It's a long journey. UX is a long journey. And I know a lot of people, they misunderstand what I'm saying and doing. And I told somebody recently and they got it. I said, I think you're applying a tone. You're looking at what I've typed on LinkedIn and you're applying a tone that doesn't match my attitude. I said, dude, this is what you do. Look at what I said, strip it of any tone. That way you can look at what's said. Don't apply a tone to it and then check it for accuracy. If you follow this advice, what will happen to you? If you can tell, what will happen to you? And that's how you get past. I mean, I've developed a science of reading emails without getting emotional behind it, because if you don't, Social media is social, which means you need social skill to optimize your operation with it. And so, but I said that to say, it's always about vaulting people forward. I've been building people since, God, somebody told me that I taught them how to play baseball. That happened in 1970.
Wow.
I've been building people for 52 years. How about that? So that's my heart. I've been like that since I was a kid. So just helping people to go forward, helping people to understand things, helping people to get better. And then when people make mistakes, as far as I'm concerned, so what? Everybody made mistakes. And I told somebody on LinkedIn last week, it's like the kid. You ever seen a kid? They're taking their first steps and they're walking to you and you're holding your arms out and the kid is coming to you and they're just, if you see the excitement on their face and they fall. The kid gets back up. I see this like 49 times out of 50. The kid will immediately never take their eyes off of you. Yep. Immediately get up and resume the journey. Why do we get older and stop doing that? It's just get up. So what? Get up. And the problem is when you don't get up and people, they take things personally. They take failure too personally. Have a passion for excellence. Yes. But give yourself room, be patient with yourself and give yourself room to then when you do skin your knee, that you can just get up and just keep going. When you do bump your head, just get up and keep going. But this whole, I don't want to talk about the demonization that takes place today at length, but people need to stop doing that. Cause they usually accuse somebody who's not doing anything wrong of it. And then they let the people that are doing weird things, they let them get away with everything under the sun. And then we suffer. So, and folks, I will say this, folks out there, don't get upset about the person who says something that's tough on you. Get upset about the person who stroked your ego when you needed a seat in the pants.
Mm.
That's the thing. I mean, somebody said to me last week, you got to remember what it was like when you were coming up. Who told you I forgot?
Right.
Who in the world told you I forgot? So we need to stop assuming things in conversations as well. I remember all too well. I remember trying to play Little League baseball. And those who never played organized sports don't understand it. You played organized sports? I mean, real organized sports, not this participation trophy mumble jumbo where you lose a soccer game 20-0 and you still get treated to pizza. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about where you had to actually qualify to make the team. Yep. And if you didn't, they sent you home and you were crying. And well, I guess you were just crying, but the rest of the team was celebrating because they made the team. Folks need to experience that because it makes you a more emotionally intelligent person. It makes you a well-rounded person and it makes your skin thicker. So when the time comes that you need to hear a hard message, you can take it because it empowers you.
100%.
It empowers you. And we just keep running into that. Oh, you made them feel bad. No, I didn't make them feel bad. They chose to feel bad because of what was said. There's a difference.
You used to have to decide. Right. You used to have to make a decision if you wanted to continue doing it.
Yes.
Right. There was a threshold. There was a precipice where you said, this is really hard. I remember almost quitting the football team because it was hard and I didn't think I was going to be able to perform. I didn't think I was going to succeed. And I remember my granddaddy told me, he said, well, you have a choice to make. You can quit the team and I'll support you, or you can go back out there and push through it and it'll be over before you know it. And you'll be playing. This was during two-a-days. I don't know if you've experienced that, but practices in the heart of summer, right. In Texas. So 110 degree weather, you know, and so it was just a hard thing, but at the end of the year, guess what? I was on the All-State team and we had a state championship ring at the end of it. So if I'd have quit, I would have lost that opportunity, but I made a decision to stay in it. And you talk a lot about this topic all the time, and I love the conversation, and it makes me think about where does the perception of cynicism come from? And I know this is like has a lot to do with like people's cognitive biases and their own filters and what's happened to them in their life. The EQ that it requires to remove emotion from a reading a post online or remove emotion from someone giving you critique is really low. It's really not a big gap. Mm-hmm. It's a very small thing to do just to say, hey, this isn't directed at me. It's directed at what I'm trying to accomplish or making me better, or it's directed at the work that I'm doing or something that I've mistaked on, you know, and the internalization of that seems to be a real struggle for a lot of people.
Yes.
I used to do the same thing to you, Darren, like before I figured it out, before I became woke, as it were. I used to do the same thing. I'd read your post and be like, man, he's just being super negative. But it wasn't negativity.
Yep.
It just felt cynicism because it wasn't what I wanted to see. Yep. Right. At the end of the day, I didn't want somebody to be telling me that this is the correct way to do it. I thought my way was the correct way. So, you know, it's a struggle for people. And I wish there was more. The thing that's really kind of irking me right now is some of the people that I've looked up to that have mentored me are fostering this behavior. And it's really starting to get under my skin, and I'm not going to point names, or we're not going to do that here, but
I know one of them because he trolls me. Not only some of these people, they troll, and exactly what you just said, and I'm going to take it a step further. They're like, I just finished watching The Offer, which is a fantastic show on Paramount Plus that shows how The Godfather was made. There are people that mimic behaviors that are associated with organized crime folks. They dispatch people to do terrible things. They incite certain behavior when they're supposed to be building folks. And we're a community.
Yeah.
We're a community. Whatever happens at Justin's job, that impacts me. Whatever happens at my job, that impacts Justin. Right. We all impact one another in UX. If you don't believe that, watch and see the day that one of your C-suite people reads an article that another C-suite person at another company wrote about UX because of the bad experiences he's having with the UXers at his company. And now you have to deal with it, and you've been doing everything right.
Yep.
We impact one another, and we have to remember that.
Right.
And it's just wild. Just such wild stuff. And I won't leave it there.
I haven't done a boot camp in a while, but do boot camps, I know you've like audited to some degree, like reviewed curriculums and things like that, but do they do like critique sessions? Like, do they do teaching on giving and receiving design feedback and critique? Are you aware of that? I've never done a boot camp.
I love how you said that. It's my understanding, and somebody respond to me and let me know that hears this. It's my understanding that they engage. I love the way it's perfect with the way you said it. I double back on that. They engage in critiques, but do they teach people how to do critiques? It's like when I think about the Google program, and there's other ones. A lot of the programs on Coursera, even the ones that are done with accredited institutions, people are engaging in peer reviews. Now, here's the thing. And I said this recently, and somebody got mad at me on LinkedIn. People don't realize when you get mad, who that says you are. People don't realize that. I said, would you ask your a friend of yours to give you a review of your dentistry? No, you would not.
If they're a dentist, maybe.
And last week I did a post, and people were commenting and didn't even understand the example I was giving. People didn't read Peanuts. I read Peanuts when I was a kid. I had a whole 10-volume set and would sit around reading Charles Schulz, the Charlie Brown comic strip. I knew what everybody was like, whether it was Violet, Schroeder, Snoopy, you name them, all the different people on the show. And so last week, I posted a picture of Lucy. Lucy Van Pelt would set up a psychiatrist booth. Mm-hmm. And charge people 5 cents to give advice. And I said that this is what people are dealing with today in UX. When they get counsel, advice from people, Lucy is not a psychiatrist. If she did, she wouldn't be charging you 5 cents.
Right.
She doesn't, you have to be licensed to do that. She just like a lot of the upstarts, when I did my recent episode on posers, retrofits, and upstarts.
Yep.
It's an upstart move on Lucy's part to just up and build a booth and put on there 5 cents and then just sit there and say the doctor is in, and you just show up and start talking to her about what's going on with you. A lot of people today are doing the same exact thing in UX, and some people got upset. But okay, you're upset. Is it true? You know, stop getting upset with me because you're only casting shade upon yourself if you get mad at me. A person in the UK once said, Darren, you sound preachy. Okay, well, that's irrelevant. Is it true? Is it true? Does it apply to you? And do you need to do anything about it? And that's the EQ response. I've even told the story about when I was getting started and early in my now known, I didn't used to give credit to myself for the work that I did early on, the information architecture work and the interaction design work and all those things. But back then I was also an instructional designer and I was a desktop publisher and I was the managing editor of a publication. And I used to do that initial work in CorelDRAW. And back in the day, we didn't have Facebook. Back then, we were all in the news groups interacting with what we do now on Facebook. We did in news groups back then. And I'm in a news group talking about design work. And a guy told me, he said, you know, you're going to love this, Justin, if you never heard me say this. He said, yeah, you know, when you get serious, you might want to start looking at Photoshop. And I went, what? I am serious.
Right.
What do you mean? That changed my life.
Yeah.
It was beautiful. I'm so glad he said it. I'm glad that he wasn't one of those people that was sparing my feelings and then holding that gold to himself. It changed my life. It was a week later, I had Photoshop. And I abandoned CorelDRAW and Corel Photo Paint and that whole suite that I was swearing by and thought it was the best thing under the sun. And I was using ULEAD Photo Impact and all these other little goofy little programs. I thought I was doing world-class work in Microsoft Publisher. I wasn't doing anything. And that launched me into the mainstream of the design world. And I never looked back because somebody told me something I needed to hear.
Wow. That's nice. I was fortunate. So there's obviously a pretty big age gap, but I was fortunate to have a bootleg copy of, I think it was Photoshop, the first one I had. And a buddy of mine gave it to me, who I still talk to today. He's actually one of the best front end engineers I know. He's the one that hooked me up, and we were pretty young. But I lost that somehow. I lost access to it, but I was still doing work with Microsoft Publisher. Don't tell anyone, but I was doing design work with Microsoft Publisher, and I thought I was really good too, man.
It's amazing, some of those old tools.
I know, they're great. Well, I did some print work for a number of years, and one of the jobs I had was a pretty common big box store that has like a built-in print shop. Mm-hmm. And they use Microsoft Publisher to set up templates for things like labels and business cards and things like
that. I remember that.
Yeah. So it was interesting, but you know, one of those things that we kind of, you know, did you forget what it was like to be new to the field?
Never. And it's funny how people will just make these assumptions that Darren Hood is trying to be a thought leader. Number one, I'm not trying to be a thought leader. I'm just doing what I can to help everybody in every situation. I love how somebody said, I believe it was Michelle Ronson that said it last week. Darren is doing all of these things and he's doing it for free. And the stuff has value. There are people who are charging you. I saw somebody last week, $5,000, $6,000, $7,000. They're charging people and they're not even, what they're doing for people is actually misleading them. People have told me that they get more from people like me. You know, the other people, Debbie Levitt, Dr. Nick. I hear people talking about you. They talk about Eric Shoemake. They talk about Michelle Ronson. They talk about people, Dr. Giles. They talk about people that are doing great things to help the discipline, and none of us are charging anything. None of us are charging. Actually, I said Michelle Ronson. She runs Curiosity Tank, but she's doing great stuff too. And she, in addition to what she's doing with Curiosity Tank, she's doing stuff that she's just helping to build people up. There are people out here that actually care. There are people out here that you listen to us, you will not regret the information that we give. But then you get people who want to be in our shoes and for some reason think that they're going to vault themselves forward by casting shade and trying to make us look bad. So, you know, more power to them, because you're not going to, when you're a proven commodity, nobody can say anything to take away from you. I worked on what was considered to be at the time the best launch site in the history of Ford Motor Company. I was the one of two information architects at the time that was devoted to that project. Actually, no, we did have the UX title by that time. And we led this project. We knocked the ball out of the park. People went to the Mojave Desert filming all these things to put on the site. They came back. I talked about it was important to have a navigation, a look and feel, and an information architecture that was reflective of or resembled the main site, and provide ways to go back and forth. And there's just a whole lot of stuff without getting into the details. We did all of these things. Nobody can take that away from me. Right. You can't take away from me that I did that. You can't take away from me that I set up a UX intranet at Bosch that helped to vault the vision that we had into being what they said was the best run UX division in a company with over 386,000 employees at the time. You can't take that away from me with these little blurs. So say what you want. Who cares? Okay. Who right. cares? Because the proof is out there and it's not going anywhere.
The proof, it matters. Like, what you've done matters, but needing to prove it doesn't matter. You're right. Just let it go. You can't take that away from anybody. And nobody's trying to take away what they've accomplished either, or what they are trying to point out what they haven't accomplished. That's the other thing, trying to point out what you haven't accomplished. Just because I haven't done it yet doesn't mean I'm not going to.
Exactly.
Right? So exactly. Give me the opportunity that I'm affording you, and let's have a conversation about, you know, how do we advance each other? Yes. That's kind of the approach that I want to take as I'm developing how I mentor people and talk to them and try to grow people into this role in this space. I kind of share the same belief with you. Like, I think the boot camps are a great place for some people to get started, if it's allowing us to be able to take the next step to expand that knowledge base, or to truly understand the discipline and where it came from. I recently posted something because I was in a thread and some folks were making some kind of wild claims about how new UX is. And in the grand scheme of things, okay, yeah, it hasn't been around for hundreds of years, right? Well, neither has technology. So let's be realistic. There's a lot to learn from the people that started this field, even as far back as the 1950s. Learn who these people are. In any other work, you know where the foundations of your field came from. You understand how those, you know, kind of move. You say art history, design. You learn about art history, where it came from.
Yes.
The different styles, like all of the different methodologies that are going into UX, there's lots of different styles. Is there stuff that's regurgitated and repackaged? Abso-freaking-lutely, right? We can't really stop that, but at least I don't think we can stop it. Maybe we can if we really all just kind of get together, but that's hard to do. But what I'm trying to say is I think that there's a lot of value in recognizing the modalities that have been developing over the years and how you can apply them. Something that was developed many, many years ago that we talked about last time, you know, like just UXing our daily lives, the 5S system, you know, that came out of the Toyota shop, I think is really, you know, those types of things are UX related. They're based on user experience. They're based on interacting and people with products and services. That's been around since the dawn of age. I think when I posted that, Eric Shoemake was pointing out that even the first tool had to be designed, right? Somebody, was going through that process of design thinking. It's not a new concept. You're just because you're saying it doesn't make it new. Anyway, just because you learned about it last week doesn't make it new.
Yeah.
So we want to keep building up, but taking a new approach to helping folks kind of unlock that there are, I don't want to frame it in a way that makes it come across as like, I think there's some procedural approach to doing our work, because
I really don't. I think that the modalities are interchangeable based on the situation.
Yeah.
It really depends on what you're doing. And I'm not a huge fan of the it depends thing, but it is actually true and relevant to the work that we do.
Yeah.
Because there's always a way. It doesn't just depend. There is a set of solutions to get you there. You just have to think critically, right? That's the hard part. So anyway, I kind of digressed on that a little bit, but I think that all of the things that we're saying, getting people back to a understanding that the people, let's call them our forefathers that have pioneered this field, have something to teach us, and everybody along the way, varying levels of experience, have something to bring to the table, and discounting them simply because they didn't teach you the course, the boot camp that you were in, or because they're approaching the problem differently, or because they're challenging your critical thinking or your responses to what's being said, is really limiting and exposing of who that person is and how they approach their work. And I probably wouldn't hire them as a UXer anyway.
You made me think about something that I'm expressing in the mentoring series, that it's funny how people say that they want a mentor, then they encounter somebody who does something reflective of mentoring and they reject it. Which is why last week I talked about, if you want to be episode 3, I should say, if you want to be a mentee, you have to be qualified to become a mentee. You don't just opt into it. If you don't have the right mentality, mentoring is not going to do anything for you. So you have to get ready for it. And so when some people, you're not going to listen to me because I'm not a part of company A mentoring group. But what I said is actually valuable. Mm-hmm. The ability to recognize value is a part of the process. Otherwise, somebody can say anything to you. I have an issue of the comic strip that I'm working on where I know you've heard people say this before. You can draw more flies with honey.
Yep.
Than you can with lemons or however the rest of that goes. Some people just say that part, and the issue of the comic strip shows a dialogue between two people, because that's actually a Freudian slip. And I had never thought about it before, because number one, who wants flies? Number one, that's part of the part of the message that's there, which turns into a Freudian slip, because Freud, or rather not Freud, but flies don't just like honey. They also like vomit. And they like poop. And a lot of people, what they're offering is vomit and poop and calling it honey.
Yeah.
If you eat poop, I know this is gross, but, you know, so be it. If you eat poop or vomit, it will have a detrimental impact on you, on your well-being.
Absolutely.
So when you think about the content that people are putting out there, I know this is a crude example, but I'm going to be on the raw side because of the benefits that will come out of it. If we look at it practically, look at what people are offering you and where it's going to take you.
Yeah.
If they make you feel good, do you need to feel good in this moment, or do you need to be steered away? Are you about to drive off of a cliff? Or do we have time to guide you through something? Because if time is of the essence, then the message to communicate to you has to be the degree of harshness, or what appears to be harsh, will increase depending upon the timing associated with what's being said. So I just never take it personally. And again, when you play, you state football champ, your coach was not stroking egos. He wasn't Mr. Rogers. I wasn't even there, and I already know that. He was more like Bobby Knight. It's more like, you better get over here, do it again.
Yep.
It was, and there was never a concern. All of the high-performing athletes that we see today, using athletes from a metaphoric perspective, are all grilled to the nth degree to achieve the level of greatness that they have. Nobody is coddled. Nobody has their ego stroked. Egos get stroked when they get into the pros, and they're making millions. They're making more money than the coach. It's different by that time, but they didn't get to that level by people coddling them. They get coddled when they become pros. A lot of them do. And we've heard about it. We've seen it. But when you're at, when you're developing from little league to high school to college, you are grilled to the nth degree. And nobody cares about your personal feelings. Everybody has a common goal. We're trying to achieve something. And everything that said, to your point you made earlier, it's about, it's never personal. It's always about helping the team to accomplish that goal. When you're focused on the goal and they're focused on the goal, nobody even cares about it. Matter of fact, when it's, you see teams when they win and everybody's celebrating. Mm-hmm. Oh, if you saw the practices, it would freak you out to hear the language and the facial expressions and the grief and the pain. Nobody sees that. So again, just reminding people of those elements, because if you digest that, it's going to vault you to a really high level of operation that you will love. Once you taste it, you don't want anything else.
I will nothing say comes without sacrifice, right? Yep. Nothing comes without sacrifice. And there's a reason why you hear those folks say, you know, I put my blood, sweat, and tears into it, because
exactly.
And broken bones and late nights. I know everybody, well, not everybody, but a lot of people would be familiar with the Remember the Titans movie,
yeah,
with Denzel Washington. And they were doing the late night practices and they were turning the headlights on the cars. That actually happens in the Deep South. If you're not familiar, we do practice at night like that, behind headlights. And when you don't see somebody coming from across the field and get your clock cleaned, because they snuck up on you, it doesn't feel very good. But what happens in the game is you don't forget that somebody could be there, right? So those experiences are important. Those when you slip up and make a mistake and you get hit hard, you remember that so that you learn from it and you don't make the mistake again. But I think a lot of the way that some of the learnings are happening today is it's so conditioned just to deliver the information it loses that opportunity to even make a mistake. And then for the people that are hiring these folks, right? Especially people who have no background in work history, like that are brand new, like have never really had a real job. I've hired boot campers before, but they had significant experience in the workforce. They had developed, yes, emotional intelligence, soft skills, and they're transitioning into a field. So they're leveling up and learning the skill sets that they can now apply to the similar type of work that they've been doing. And those people are usually pretty successful that I've interviewed and worked for. They perform. But the ones that haven't had those blows and have not been exposed, so to speak, to the dangers of the real world and the business and the activities that go on. There's another post that's been floating around that I've been commenting on and seeing some other posts happening around the political landscape. And somebody said, "Oh, you know, yeah, we should make it a job requirement to for designers to be able to navigate politics effectively." And so I've got this new mantra. I'm trying to play 4D chess instead of 3D chess. It was 3D chess. But now I'm trying to play 4D chess. So I'm thinking that the design leaders that we need now know how to get rid of politics in the workplace and get rid of politics in the decision-making process and subjugate the politics, because the politics are inevitably going to drive a poor decision because it doesn't require the same amount of information or the right information to make the decision. They're highly emotionally based. They're very stakeholder-driven opinions. So that's the game I'm playing today, is how do we shift that?
Yeah. I've been a big advocate for years and talking about, well, number one, we said this earlier, doing UX work is about, I'm not even going to throw a number on it, but it's partly about doing the work and it's partly about managing all these other things. Yeah. It's about sales. It's about customer service. It's about, and this is the part I was getting at, managing politics. You have to be able to at least be aware of the politics, attempt to manage it. And if nothing else, because sometimes you can't, all you can do is try, but you can manage the team's response.
Yeah.
To the politics, if nothing else. And so those things, the more somebody is aware of those things, the better off they are, and the better they're going to be able to bring value to their team because of that politics piece. And which is why it takes thick skin to be a UX professional, because it's just wild. Matter of fact, the Venn diagram, I modified that old classic Venn diagram where you have user needs, business needs, and they used to always say technical constraints. And, and when I taught a UX 101 class at a company I used to work at, I designed and taught the class, was part of the certification process. I would spend a lot of time talking about those constraints because they could be budget oriented. They could be financial. They could be technology oriented. Mm-hmm. It could be personnel oriented. Maybe you don't have the people, the human resources you need to get it done. It could be time-based constraints, and it could be politically oriented constraints. And a lot of times we still have to try to find the sweet spot. Not a lot of times, all the time. We still have to find the sweet spot between those three factors, and the constraints are very complex when you go well beyond the technical constraints to get the work done. So when you do that, you're not going to fix that with Figma. That's not how it works. So folks can talk about Figma all they want and be as good in Figma as you want to be. If you're good at Figma, great. I celebrate you, but I also want to give you a dose of reality in that you're not going to solve the vast majority of UX problems with any tool, Figma or anything else, because a lot of the problems and the challenges that we deal with have nothing to do with a tool. You're not going to use a wrench to do the work of a Phillips head screwdriver. It just doesn't work that way. You're not going to be able to bring a saw and take care of what you need a sandpaper for. It just doesn't work. So we need the right tools for the right things. And Figma has its place and other tools have their place. Right. But you're not there is no one tool that's going to address all the needs of UX. So folks have to wake up. And that's another thing. I get in trouble for saying that, but I'm not going to take it back. That's just the way it is. And if folks don't believe me, go and try to solve the issues and watch and be realistic and watch and see what happens. When your stakeholders tell you about a problem they have, just open up Figma and show Figma and act like you dropped the mic and watch and see how long you're in that room before they run you out. Because they know what everybody knows. And there is no discipline that one tool takes care of everything.
Yep.
None. And so same applies to us.
Well, and you know, on this topic related to tooling and related to, you know, and not solving all the problems also connects to accountability. It also connects to, you know, having some level of discipline in the field to make the right decisions.
Yep.
We could apply gatekeeping to that to some degree. Yep. I was trying to avoid using that term, but we could apply some gatekeeping here. But I think that the most valuable tool that gets overlooked often is the squishy stuff between the ears. And it comes, again, it's coming back to the critical thinking skill set. Yep. I'd love to see more companies, have, instead of like these technical training programs, of having critical thinking training programs, strategic thinking training programs.
For sure.
And I think this ties back to accountability from the executive leadership teams down to the folks that are doing the work of transparency also affords a certain level of accountability and gatekeeping. When you start talking about sports teams, everybody has the same goal, right? That's why teams work, right? There are usually not a lot of politics in teams, right? Because everyone's going after the same thing and everybody knows what their role is and what their job is play by play. I know exactly what I'm doing as a center. I'm snapping the ball and I'm blocking the guy and not letting the quarterback get hit. I know what I'm doing. The quarterback knows what he's doing. We all have the same goal, which is to win the game and get the touchdown. We don't have that level of transparency a lot of times in our workplace because it's not getting rolled down, right? And so that opens up the door for poor accountability. It opens up a lack of gatekeeping on what our goals and our missions are going to be and helping us to tighten our scope so we can stay focused because people just don't know. Everybody thinks that we're just trying to all accomplish the same thing. But in the reality, if you've ever done a stakeholder interview series, every stakeholder has a different goal. They're all responsible for something else.
Yep.
Right. So, I think that's a really important point that it's just, it's all connected. And you have to be able to critically think and you have to be able to strategize on your work. And you can use tools to do that and visualize it and help you, to your point.
But you have to have the right tools for the job. And the squishy stuff between the ears is the most important one. So exercise that one the most.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But we are an hour in. We touched on some of the topics without getting into them formally, but we're going to start to come in for a landing. We talked to the tower. We got permission to land, so to speak.
Love it. Yeah.
And I'm going to jump straight to, we're going to wrap up with the fifth topic that I had on my list.
Okay.
So we're jumping dramatically. We already touched on gatekeeping. Yep. We got into democratization a lot. Not a whole, well, a little bit, but not a lot. I don't think we touched on it very much. We didn't do that justice. So maybe another time on that. But staffing and hiring is an issue in UX today. So we're going to wrap up today talking about staffing and hiring and our thoughts about that. And we go as broad or as narrow as you want. But where would you start there in addressing the topic of staffing and hiring, that whole HR, human resources related aspect of the UX job?
Right now, so I think we can't not talk about what's happening in the world right now as a result of this. I think the economy has a lot to do with what's happening from a staffing process right now, the market that we're looking at, and especially in the U.S., I understand that a lot of countries are experiencing the same problems and challenges we are with inflation and layoffs and things like that. But I know more about what's happening here in the U.S., so I can speak to that. Recently, I had a job offer, a candidate come across my email from a recruiter who said, "Hey, I've got this candidate. He's got 4 years of experience, and he's been working for some really powerful startups," or powerful. I don't even know what that adjective means in that case, but they're working for some startups and doing some very, very solid work. And he's looking for $200,000 a year.
Whoa. And,
yeah. So, and I will say this, what's happening in the market right now is not sustainable. If you're getting these types of offers and you're getting, people are coming to you and saying, "Hey, I can get you 200K. They may be able to get that. And here's the reality of it. If the startup or the company has the bandwidth to take that risk and can afford you that opportunity, you know, good on them. And maybe it's a risk that makes financial sense to them. But here's the reality of it. Darren and I both know that when the push comes to shove, design is going to get laid off just like everybody else. And sometimes they're going to go first. Yep. You know, you'll see consultants start going, you'll start seeing, you know, low level, junior level designers start going, you'll start seeing management levels start going from design, because the reality is people think they can do our job or that our job is not necessary. So I just want to put a warning out there to people. If you're getting these really lucrative job offers and you know without a doubt that you really don't have the experience to justify that, be warned. It's not sustainable, and there's a high likelihood that I don't want to discourage people. That's the worst part of this. Like, good on you. If you're able to convince and negotiate a company to give you an astronomical salary based on, you know, your experience, because the world is in a weird place. Inflation is record highs. Gas is record highs. I paid $6.50 for fuel yesterday in my truck per gallon. And I get it. We need to be able to sustain and have better income for our homes. But the reality is we're on the brink of some really, I'm not an economist, but all the things are pointing in that direction. You know, things are going to start happening. We're already seeing massive layoffs in the tech industry. So just be careful with that kind of stuff. I would say here's what I see most. With the exception of you being in a toxic environment, you are not in a toxic environment. Mm-hmm. This is a really good opportunity to dig your heels in, do something spectacular, because on the backside of this market, the ones that are going to succeed are the ones that are going to have the innovation opportunities. They're going to have the new ideas. They're going to have the fresh approach. Those are the people that are going to be successful on the backside of this whole thing. The jumping ship for the money, I get it. Like, that's the best way to get a raise right now. But the reality is to invest in what you've invested in. Take a really good look and stock in what you've accomplished, what you've worked on, where you've invested the blood, sweat, and tears, the people on your team that you've already been working with, and invest in that. It's not always about the money. So that's where I would start this conversation, or maybe close it. I don't know how much time we have left.
That's fantastic. I actually don't want to add anything else to that. And I think people need to take that to heart. It's a wild landscape. We're already in the wild, wild west of UX.
Yeah.
For several different reasons. And now people are expecting salaries that are completely unrealistic. And if something unrealistic happens, then something very realistic is going to happen behind that. And it's not going to be very desirable. So folks need to be ready. If you're getting paid, I hope you're doing a good job of saving, because it's a matter of time before somebody wants to make a change.
Well, here's the reality of it too. If you are coming out of a boot camp and you don't have the blood, sweat, and tears that we keep talking about in this episode, this is the blood, sweat, and tears episode, apparently. You don't have those blows. You haven't had your clock cleaned yet by a linebacker running across the field blindsiding you. The reality is you're going to fail, and it's okay to fail. Like, that's not the point of the conversation, but you are going to fail at some point, and then they're going to be looking at the highest paid person that failed to recoup that cost.
Yeah.
So that's another reality of it. So just need to be aware.
It's amazing how those things work out. But let's make sure, I mean, you're getting a lot of great information here. Make the most of it. If you want to be in UX, you have subscribed to being a realist. You want to be in UX, you subscribe to lifelong learning. You want to be in UX, you need to make sure that you understand that we are a community and we affect one another in what we do. Matter of fact, those salaries, those exorbitant, undeserved salaries, will have a ripple effect across the discipline. And it is what it is. I always come back there. I'm always grounded in it is what it is. It might look crazy, but it is what it is. Okay, so what are we going to do to manage it? What do I need to do to manage myself in the midst of this? And then, okay, it is what it is, and we go on from there. So, yeah, I think that's a great place to wrap up today, Justin, and I appreciate that. So thanks again for joining me on today. I don't even care that we didn't get to that other stuff. I think this is a really big, I love what you said, the blood, sweat, and tears, and that's what we're going to call this.
Hey, how about it?
The blood, sweat, and tears episode, because it's a reality check. And the more realistic you are, the better you're going to be, the better equipped you're going to be mentally, and the better equipped you're going to be emotionally, because your expectations will always be more closely aligned with what's really going to take place. So you remain more grounded, and it helps you to maintain motivation, and you stay on top of your mental wellness and all those types of things because of where your head is, and not like these people with the toxic positivity, because that stuff will blow up on you after a while. It's like eating a stick of dynamite. It's gonna come back and it's gonna get you. I've seen people on social media who just gotta have the smoke blown up their rear.
Right.
And that's not gonna work. Nope. Eventually. And then they avoid people like me, because I'm just gonna tell you what is. And people tell me all the time, thanks for keeping it real. Thanks for being honest. Thanks for being transparent. You know, even though some people, they hate it, and that's fine. I'm not here to be loved. I really don't care. People will say that Darren, you're giving these people too much energy and you're doing this, that, and the other. I would say, you don't really understand what I'm doing. And I'm a mega, mega, mega vet of dealing with people like this. And if you have not, you might want to hold off on giving me advice too quick, because you don't know what I know. Matter of fact, you should come at me with some questions about what's really going on. It's an issue of today of making sure to optimize where we are. It's making sure to understand the different dynamics that we're being surrounded by. I said this earlier, I'm going to say it again. I'm going to wrap up here. I want to see everybody go forward. I take a stand for what I take a stand for, because I want to see people go forward. And I've said this all the time. I say it often. I feel a sense of indebtedness to the discipline, so I give back. That's why I say what I say. I'm almost, you didn't know this, Justin, I was ready to walk away from LinkedIn. Like 100% cold turkey, just walk away, because I get tired, honestly, of the people and some of the things that they do. It's when you consider people to have no idea how much people like me give of ourselves. They have no idea. They have no idea the sacrifices that we make. They have no idea of the burden, how heavy the burden is. That we're doing this because we just got a big heart. And then people flip and try to make it seem like it's something else. I love what I do. I love seeing people who love what they do, who love what they're getting into. I just want to help. That's basically it. And I'm going to wrap up because I'm going to go down another tangent. I'm just going to stop. I forget it. It's just, but I do want to I do want to say that. Please understand. If you don't understand, so be it. Like I said, I'm not here to be loved, welcome, or understood. I'm here to help. And so if you, I think that's what I was trying to get at the whole time. If you accept that help, great. If you don't, fine. It doesn't, I'm not losing energy because of that. But I do know that if you say nothing, then you're actually emboldening and equipping and licensing what's being done. And I refuse to do that. So that's it. That's my take on that. And if you think that, oh, Darren, you worry about it too much. Really? You really think I'm worrying about it too much? You really think that? Well, then more power to you too. And then I make a note of you. Because now I know who you are too. And I told somebody once, I tell this often, I make a persona of everybody I meet. I do it automatically. I don't even have to think about it. So, and when I see somebody, I've seen that person 500 times. I've seen that person 35 times. And now I know, okay, now you see that person. Now you need to respond doing this, and this. So I'm not stopping. I was going to walk away from LinkedIn. I'm not walking away from LinkedIn. I was ready.
Yeah.
I was ready. Boy, that was going to be peaceful. I have taken a sabbatical from LinkedIn. I might do that.
But it's all right to take breaks. Breaks are good. People get burned out all the time. You got to take a break. Don't get burned out.
There you go. And that's it. I was burned out. Burned out from LinkedIn. Burned out from giving. And people, my LinkedIn inbox is jammed. And people have no idea. I don't charge people for this.
Yeah.
I don't charge anybody. I don't get paid for setting up the UX chit chat hour. I did gave an emotional intelligence talk at one company I used to work at, and I've worked for a lot of toxic companies. Yeah. And I gave my emotional intelligence talk, which resulted in a riot, the equivalent of a riot starting, because they were angry when they found out what my EQ score was and found out what theirs was. They responded by proving why their scores were so low. And a riot broke out on the spot. And just a lot of the same kind of slinging of insults and all types of overly emotionally aggressive statements. And here's some books that I said at the end, here's some books. If you want to learn more about emotional intelligence, here's a list of books that you can check out. And I'll send you the PDF. The links are all live. Well, you making some money off of affiliates on Amazon? I'm like, these people, no matter what you say and what you do, you said the word earlier perfectly. The cynicism is off the charts, and cynicism is not healthy.
Yeah.
It's not healthy, and it will lower your ceiling. And it is an EQ. I listed as an EQ red flag when I did that series. So, folks, don't be. If you're one of those people, just lose it. Fine, make the switch, make the change. And if you used to be, they said Justin said he used to respond a certain way to the things I posted, but here we are. People can become something else. And I want to be here when those cases come about to help people be exactly that. That's why I keep doing this show. So we can help people and talking about things that nobody else is pretty much talking about. I dare somebody to accuse of that because they've done that too. So, but that's it. We're going to end there because my soapbox is always ready to go. So I'm going to lock my soapbox up. We're going to end it here. Again, thanks for coming out, Justin. I appreciate that. And of course, we got to connect another time. We got to get you and Eric on the same show.
Yeah, that'd be good.
That'd be fun. You folks used to work together too. That'd be fun. And I love Eric's take on things. But we're going to wrap up here, folks. So thank you, all of you who joined us on today. Tell your friends. How about truth go viral for once?
Hashtag the truth.
Share the podcast with your friends. Get the word out. And we'd love to have more and more folks listening. And if you ever get any ideas or something you'd like to hear me cover, just reach out on LinkedIn. Send me a note. Reach out to our private social media network called Engage, which some people don't even know about. So we don't have to deal with the algorithms. We get out there. We have a conversation. I started to shut that down, but somebody said, no, let's try it. Let's try it. Keep it going. So we're doing that. So I'll probably post a link to Engage with the podcast notes. Let's keep the conversation going. Let's keep helping one another. Let's keep the trajectory of UX as much as we can going upward, folks.
Yes.
But that is all the time we have for today. So on behalf of Justin Ratton and me, Darren Hood, the host of The World of UX, it's time to sign off. So until next time, happy UXing, everybody.
Thanks for joining us for this session of CX of M Radio. Be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to the show, and visit cxofm.org for more resources.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.